From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Perlot, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies, and welcome to Worldviews. Rebecca Cruz and I will talk about some of the international reaction to this year's presidential election and how other countries view some of the candidates.
So people in the Middle East are paying attention to that and wondering what that will mean in terms of Syria, in terms of the refugee situation in the Middle East, North African area.
Then I'll talk with University of Central Oklahoma political scientist Hassan Mohammed. He argues U.S. support for a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is more of a shift in rhetoric rather than actual power.
It's easy to gamble on the Palestinian cause. The United States is involved in so many conflicts and issues, especially in the Arab Springs, that it put the Palestinian issue on the side.
U.S. policy toward the Muslim world and the Arab-Israeli conflict. Right after this hour's news. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grolot. Well, Rebecca Cruz, we can't get out of this season without talking about U.S. presidential elections, particularly from a global perspective. There's a lot to be said about what people are saying around the world about our presidential election process in and of itself, but also some of the candidates. It's interesting to see how people are kind of lining up, what the public opinion is in certain parts of the world, certain regions. Obviously, really, everyone's just talking about Trump and Clinton at this point. But there are those that are really for Trump and really opposed to Trump, and some that are kind of wishy-washy on Hillary. But there's kind of a lot of nervous laughter going on around the world. And in fact, sometimes not even nervous laughter, just laughter, because they're thinking, well, this is all a show, like reality TV. So what are we to make of global public opinion right now about our presidential election process?
Well, the world always watches these presidential elections in the United States fairly closely, and this has perhaps been even more closely watched, perhaps also because it's lasted so long. It seems like we've been going through this process for some time, and we have some noted figures that would be familiar on the international stage. Most people around the world know who Hillary Clinton is, obviously because of her husband, but also because of her role as Secretary of State and some of the actions she took during that time. And then Donald Trump, if they didn't know who he was before, they certainly know who he is now. And he's often known as the guy from Apprentice, or happens to be the millionaire that's built these towers in their major cities. So that's been very interesting. But as you said, a lot of people are looking at this as kind of a reality television. And with, as you also mentioned, some nervous laughter, it's perhaps gotten to the point where it's not just funny anymore, that there is a serious concern that if he were to be elected, there's some policies perhaps that he would initiate that are somewhat troubling. So if we think of countries in the Middle East, for example, he said some pretty disparaging things about Muslims in this country. And so people in the Middle East are paying attention to that and wondering what that will mean in terms of Syria, in terms of the refugee situation in the Middle East, North African area. And also Hispanics, of course, in the Latin America, also having some similar concerns because of remarks.
But Russia has come out directly endorsing Trump. This is very interesting. President Putin, back in December, in fact, actually endorsed Trump. And so how are Americans to respond to that, that they're going to vote for somebody that the Russian president would endorse?
It's fascinating, isn't it? I think in some ways you can see the similarities between a Trump and a Putin presidency, kind of the macho male that's really kind of pushing their firm beliefs and that sort of thing. So perhaps it's not surprising. And we would expect that Putin's policies would line up fairly closely with a Trump presidency, that there wouldn't be the antagonism that perhaps has existed in the last couple of years, and maybe the United States would back away from some of its policies towards Russia. One of the other things that's been really interesting is some of the comparisons to Berlusconi. You've spent time in Italy, the Berlusconi years, and there were multiples of them, but the comparison there, and one of the things I read that was so interesting is that Berlusconi said some very disparaging things about women, and yet housewives were amongst his biggest fans. And we see some of that happening here in this country with Trump. Some of the things that have been said about the lack of knowledge and education about some of the people in this country, and yet some of those same people are big supporters of Trump. So really being able to tap into certain populations while perhaps even offending them in some ways.
Well, certainly the reality TV nature of this election with Trump's involvement brings up images of Berlusconi. Well, some around the world, of course, are suggesting they're sad to see Obama go, and others are pretty happy to see him go. Israel seems to be happy to see him go, and others, like South Africa, for example, really concerned about him going. So that's another element here is I guess, regime change in the United States.
Well, absolutely. Folks in Africa really saw him, an African-American, ascending to the White House, and there was some symbolic imagery there. So, yes, I'm sure they're sad to see him go, as well as the policies that he enacted.
Well, we have many months to go, so we'll be returning to this subject eventually again. So thank you very much, Rebecca, as always, for being here.
Thank you.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about this show or answer any questions you might have. Leave your comments on this episode in the Worldview section of KGOU.org, or you can tweet us at WorldviewsKGOU or at Suzak Rolat. After a short break, I'll talk with University of Central Oklahoma political scientist Hassan Mohammed. He'll offer his take on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I'm Suzak Rolat, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzak Rolat. Today I'm joined by Hassan Mohammed. He's a political scientist at the University of Central Oklahoma, where he studies the Arab-Israeli conflict, democratization in the region, and Islamist movements. He's been with UCO since 1999, but has also spent time at Qatar University in Doha. He studied there as a Fulbright Scholar in 2007 and 2008, and served as a visiting professor from 2012 to 2015. Hassan Mohammed, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you. Pleasure.
You study Palestine, Middle East in general, but in particular focusing on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Can you give us kind of an update as of right now, kind of where we are in that conflict and that standoff in terms of kind of hot conflict, hot zones versus, you know, a stalemate? I mean, where are we in this situation?
For the most part, it is a stalemate. And if you look at the past two decades or more, the impression is that negotiations would be the solutions that would result in a two-state solution. And Palestinians had high hopes, Israelis perhaps the same. But the course of negotiations itself led to nowhere. And who to blame? Not just one party. Also, you can blame the United States for not being aggressive enough to enforce a solution or to bring cooperation between the two sides that would lead to a conclusion that would raise the hopes of the Palestinians and also make Israelis feel secure, because Israelis, in the final analysis, cannot stay the way they are without a solution to their neighbor, which is the Palestinians. But also, you can also look at the Palestinians themselves. They have problems, internal problems. They have geographical divisions. They have political divisions. They have heated controversies between Islamists and nationalists. Add into that, you have the region that is suffering from turmoil. You have the Arab Spring. So the Palestinians were sidelined regionally, internationally, and locally they are suffering from internal conflicts and strifes. And the balance of power has always been in Israel's interest. So they cannot really challenge Israel. I mean, if Abu Mazen himself want to go from point A to point B, he would have to ask for a permit from the Israelis to travel. So the Palestinian negotiators are very weak, very unable, maybe willing, but they are unable to deliver for the Palestinians. All of this basically lead to the present situation, which is a continuation of the same exact situation that was before, which is continuation of Israel's military occupation, continuations of policies that are aggressive against the Palestinians, continuation of Palestinian resistance that sometimes become quite violent, continuations of humiliation, restrictions on travel. Basic needs and services for the Palestinians are very limited. From the Palestinian point of view, they want to change the status quo. From the Israeli point of view, they don't want to change the status quo. Because to change the status quo without being certain that it's going to lead to stability that would benefit the state of Israel is more risky than keeping the state of Israel and maintaining occupation. For the American administrations, it's easy to gamble on the Palestinian cause. The United States is involved in so many conflicts and issues, especially in the Arab Springs, that it put the Palestinian issue on the side. So the situation is really hard and very difficult.
I'm talking with University of Central Oklahoma political scientist Hossam Mohammed about the conflict between Israel and Palestine. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. I'm Suzette Gorlot, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlot, the dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. My guest today is Hossam Mohammed, a political scientist at the University of Central Oklahoma in Edmond. He's been sharing his thoughts about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
Let's talk a little bit more about the United States and the U.S. role in the negotiation process. Now, you've written extensively about U.S. administrations and the role that they've played. Some suggest that the United States is not necessarily an honest broker because it's obviously very pro-Israeli. But there's a large contingency in the United States of support for the Palestinians as well. It's a very complicated situation. But how would you rate the United States' role? I mean, you mentioned blame for the U.S., but let's look specifically at administrations. If you look back, you know, over the Clinton administration and then the Bush administration and then the Obama administration, kind of how each of these administrations stack up. Are they, you know, approaching the situation, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and those negotiations in a different way? It seems to me it's fairly consistent, but I don't know. What about the details of each administration?
Well, the United States has been always consistent in its approach toward the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. If we look regionally, the main concern of the United States is to maintain and preserve stability in the region. The United States' fundamental interests are in the Arab world, in the Muslim world. They have so much investment, so much interest, especially when it comes to oil. Security of the State of Israel is one of those fundamental goals that the United States have and remain and continue and perhaps will continue to do so. Without the United States' support, a lot of experts would raise questions about the status of Israel, the future of Israel, the historical legacy of Israel, all of these kinds of things. If we start, like, let's say, with the Clinton administration, probably that was one of the first administrations that tried to resolve the conflict, especially in 2000. And in the year 2000, you have the Camp David summit in which Bill Clinton tried to bring about an agreement. But the agreement at the end resulted in giving the Palestinians less than what their fundamental goals were, which is a withdrawal of Israel from territories that it occupied in the 1967 war. And that would be about 22-23% of historic Palestine. So let's say, generally speaking, the United States wanted to Israel wanted to withdraw from 95% of the West Bank. There were few minor disagreements. Actually, exchanges of land were suggested in Taba and other negotiations that followed the Camp David, but never really been concluded. So that was probably the closest time in which a resettlement could have been reached. The United States have never acknowledged or recognized the national rights or claims of the Palestinians, strangely, until the Bush administration came into power, which the Bush administration basically said, we support the two-state solution. This was not the official policy of the United States. This sounds strange or a shift in the United States policy. But sadly, it was a shift in rhetoric more than in conduct, because the Bush administration, when it promoted the two-state solution, it basically, at the same time, let Israel do whatever it wishes to do in the occupied territories. So in rhetoric, the Bush administrations, even the Obama administrations to a certain degree, and I'll come to the Obama administration, continued to support the two-state solution in principle. And by the way, the two-state solution in principle have international backing. So it is perhaps the most viable solution to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. It's much more popular than other solutions. So then why the United States would come and support such a solution? Well, the fear were about the one-state solution is that even from Israeli point of view, the Israelis support. There is a large number of Israelis who support the two-state solution. But they wanted to do that only in Israel's term, which means you maintain and preserve the security considerations of Israel, which could be at the expense of the future Palestinian state. For example, if you're negotiating for a two-state solution and at the same time you're building settlements on the same land that you're going to divide into two states, it does not make sense, because that very land you're negotiating to divide is now being occupied by settlers. And various laws and policies that annex significant parts from the West Bank, expanding Jerusalem area to be part of Israel. So from Palestinians' point of view, they're stuck, they're held in a process which they became afraid of, a process that is unending. From the Israeli point of view, which is supported by the United States, two things are important. One, you want to maintain the Jewishness of Israel. So any possibility other than two-state solutions should not be on the agenda. Any outside interventions from Europeans or the United Nations or the Russians is not allowed. United States have monopoly over the solutions of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. But at the same time, that monopoly aims more than anything else at, one, preserving the Jewishness of the state of Israel, meaning Arabs, even Israeli Arabs, are questioned whether they should be or should remain in the future as part of Israel. They are part of Israel. And if you look at the Palestinian side, to give them a state the way they are asking for it, it has to be limited, restricted, meaning when I go to the West Bank and I go there twice a year, the first person that check my papers, my documents, my passport is an Israeli. And then I go, and then the Palestinians, after half an hour drive, they'll start checking your documents. When I leave, the last person from the Palestinian territories that would check and investigate you is an Israeli. So there is no sovereignty, no Palestinian sovereignty in the present status quo. That is convenient for Israel, because Israel can maintain its security without any regard or fundamental regard to the security of the Palestinians, to the life of the Palestinians. Add into that, when you travel, and I do that inside the territories, I go through sometimes to just go visit my aunt for 20 minutes usually. I go through 5 hours, and I'm not exaggerating. It could be 20 minutes. It could be 5 hours. It depends on the checkpoints. And those checkpoints can really put you on hold for a long time. And by the way, it's not because of security arrangements.
Well, this is what I was going to ask, is this not related to the security concerns that Israel has? I mean, they obviously have an experience of Palestinian resistance, violent resistance.
That's true. There are things that make sense to focus on the security issues. But between Palestinian villages and towns, there are no security risks or very little security risks. And you would keep Palestinians on daily basis stranded on checkpoints for a long time. And there are highways that are considered special highways for settlements. Palestinians, and I was one of them, would have to go through very horrible routes to get from point A to point B. They're not allowed by law to drive on Israeli highways. They're not allowed to go through Israeli checkpoints that are for Israelis, because there are checkpoints for Israelis, but those are for the security arrangements you're talking about. The checkpoints for Palestinians are mostly to make the life of the Palestinians miserable, humiliated. I took my kids who were born in the United States, lived in the United States, and they stood with me on those checkpoints, and my son looked at me and said, but they don't even check our IDs. So there was no real justifications for many of the complexities. And I am just visiting for a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks. What about those people that I know in every town that have to live this life for their – they've been cheated out of life.
Well, clearly this is a terribly complicated situation. And so given, you know, the situation as you've characterized it, what do you think the solution is going to be? I mean, you've mentioned the status quo is something right. that's likely to be maintained. But just, you know, quickly, what hope can we have that this is going to change in terms of how they're treating each other, how they're able to overcome and resolve this conflict?
Everybody knows what's the final solution is going to be. It's divorce. When you are at a conflict as such, you have to create two settings, two entities. And the Palestinians must have the fundamental basic rights, sovereignty, statehood, return of refugees, security, removal of Israeli settlements from the territories. And then the Palestinians would have something to lose. So they would definitely try to preserve as much as possible. Now, I cannot guarantee no violence would take place. Yes. But, I mean, violence can happen anywhere in the world. I'm talking about here mass violence, potentials for mass violence if you maintain the status quo, possibly a third intifada. Or the other alternative, if it's not a two-state solution, is to have one state. A lot of Palestinians start to support the one-state solution. And the one-state solution is basically saying, we can live under Israel, that's fine. Just give us equal fundamental rights. And Israel is saying no, because you cannot be citizens of the state of Israel, because that would ruin the Jewishness of the state of Israel. So if you're a Palestinian, you're basically told you cannot be a member, a resident of the state, because you're not Jewish, and you have to be somewhere else. Somewhere else where? I would accept if it is another state, but it's not another state. So in the final analysis, if it is not the two-state solution, Israel probably will never accept the one-state solution. Palestinians would remain under the same status quo for many years to come. The reactions to the status quo, we have seen it, would be violence in part, sometimes perhaps peaceful resistance. There are movements around the world that are pressuring Israel, but Israel is not really paying attention as long as the United States remains on its side.
All right. Well, Hassam, thank you so much for being here today and trying to bring some sense to a situation that many of us find very difficult and confusing and frustrating. So thank you for being here and providing us your thoughts.
Thank you. Appreciate it. It's my pleasure.
You've been listening to our conversation with University of Central Oklahoma political scientist Hassam Mohammed. We have more information on our website, kgou.org. The views and opinions this half hour do not necessarily reflect those of KGOU, its staff, or the University of Oklahoma's Board of Regents, which holds our broadcast license. Worldviews is a collaborative partnership between KGOU and OU's College of International Studies. Sam Dupre produces the show, and Brian Hardzinski edits the interviews and produces our digital content. For Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Gorlott.